dole out grants and this and that. No, that kind of thing never influenced. They may have occasionally helped somebody, and it happens in any minister. Mm-hmm. But he had no such conscious objective, because the handling of the grants and so on really was done by the department.
Mm-hmm.
And very rarely did he say, I want such and such a grant given to such and such a village committee. He never made that kind of business.
Well, that's very interesting.
He was a democratic minister.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was chairman of the Local Government Service Commission, because when the commission was established in 1947-45, it was established, and Kannangar was there in 46. I became acting commissioner in 47, permanent in 48. And from 48 to 51, he was minister until he resigned in 51. Now, there was never an instance in which he ever gave me a direction to appoint X, Y or Z to a job. That speaks volumes to for a minister.
Mm-hmm.
A man of that caliber who could really have dictated to me, really, because he had to fight against all odds to get make me.
Could he constitutionally dictate to you?
Then he could have asked me what the constitutional procedure. He said, I say, Jayasuri, I want you to appoint so and so to this post. I am chairman of the LGSC. If I cannot do that, can really say I have no confidence in you, no? And that is the end. So I think one must pay a very, very great tribute to him, to have not been gone down to that level of directing a man to do it.
What about the budgetary aspect, grants? I was wondering whether he could have used that.
Well, that's why most people accused him of doing it, which is all wrong. It is not so. Because we in the department handle these things, we know it for a certainty that it never happened, except occasionally something, somebody say, a chairman comes to him and says, well, this is very urgent thing, this bridge is broken down, for the last 3 years they haven't been able to repair it, so won't you give us something for this, because otherwise we will be getting the blame from these people. So he sends down a note to the commissioner of local government and says, please look into this and see, this is something that is a deserving, get the ACLG to inspect it, and if you consider it a deserving case, you may take suitable action. That's about all. You will forget about it after doing that.
Isn't it correct to say that DS and OEG and others didn't like his popularity and the fact that he had all these committees with him, shall I say?
Yes.
And tried to counteract this by through that rural development?
Yes, that is the current opinion then and even now, that they tried to break his power and influence by bringing this wedge of the rural development and trying to step up a rival body to the village committee.
Mm-hmm.
And that that towards that end they got this question of grants, reduction in the grants given, and various things, putting up the rival local rural development people against local governing bodies and so on. So there is reason to think that there was such a thing, because we in the department also sometimes felt that there was, the government was giving so much emphasis, very much more emphasis to that rural development aspect than local governing bodies.
I was wondering whether Mr. Bandaranaike commented to you at any time about this, what they were doing, you know, see what these fellows are doing and...
No, he never commented. In fact, there was no comment, but actually once he had an interview with this EAP Vijayaratne, who was the Minister of Home Affairs. Because this rivalry was coming to a head almost, and there were certain cabinet papers, I think, which were put up, and so he wanted an interview with Vijayaratne. And across the table he told Vijayaratne, don't you try and run away with the idea that you can suppress local government institutions by coming and doing this kind of thing, by putting these addresses. Let us work together and see whether we cannot do it in a better way.
But if they were having rural government, shouldn't they have been amalgamated? That
would have been the proper thing to have done, but then if their objective was else, other thing, you couldn't have expected that. No?
So in a sense there were two parallel bodies?
Well, yeah, that's what, apparently at that time that was the that was the trend.
Did you find that in fact in specific cases there were clashes
We had any amount of instances of clashes and so on. Where there was the local authorities influence being undermined, we found that on there.
I raised this question because I was wondering whether it was one factor, even perhaps the immediate cause of Mr. Bandaranaike's crossover.
Not necessarily one. He felt that there were so many factors at work, and there was a feeling that he should, things were becoming one by one, the screws were being tightened all around and various things were being done, making it very hot for him, and he felt that it was better to go now rather than go. He felt that he should take a step forward and...
Did he tell you this or...?
No, he did not. I as a public servant never discussed politics in that way with him. So probably other public servants do it today. I never did it. I carried out his policy about all. This kind of thing I heard from other members of parliament and so on who moved closely with him and so on. I think I must take my hat off to him for that. He never wanted to get a public servant on his side in that way. But he knew his policy, my policy is this. And he expected you to carry out that policy.
Was he a man who concentrated on the broad outlines of policy, or did he also go into details?
Always on broad lines of policy. He was, that is why I said it is to get a man like him, to work with him, it was an intellectual treat. You knew a man who knew what he was about and who could see even a local matter in the context of a world event, you see. He is such a man of such intellectual ability, far and away above these things. He really couldn't get down to these ordinary details. He was lost.
No, I was wondering whether sometimes he tended to be too general and go off on a tangent.
No, he didn't go off on a tangent, but sometimes he used to think in a non-practical way, in the sense that thinking well about the realms is like the eagle that was soaring while the lesser beings were all down.
Yes, when you comment about international events, I was wondering when sometimes he suddenly got a bright idea and said, expounded on a sort of very academic and interesting theme, but something which may not have been...
No, he never did anything that was impractical. Mm. He was essentially practical-minded, but his thoughts were always on a very large scale, you see. He was always concerned with world events and world's attention and how even in an address to the, for instance, the Urban Council, District Conference and so on, he would address an audience. Generally, he will take the local governing matters in a very general way, and then he switches over to the to the international scene, world events and the age of the common man and this kind of thing and so on. He always comes up to the higher level.
But administratively, I thought he would have been rather difficult to work with. Wasn't he rather unpunctual?
No, he had his own way. He was in the sense that now you never expect him, say, if you expect him at 9, he comes at 9:30, that kind of thing. That was a lot of habit, mannerism probably with him and nothing, but that had nothing to do with anything. Now he never kept, for instance, if there was a conference on, he never kept people waiting. Maybe 5-10 minutes late he comes. That had nothing to do with
it. I was wondering whether he was late when it came to meeting deputations.
No, not as such, you see. He may have, sometimes, after all, you must remember, he's a very busy man, no? Then hundreds of people at his home, you see, waiting, and he has to deal with them, and then he has to come to office. Sometimes he used to get off late, but there was also an idea created around that he was unpunctual and he was very brusque with people and so on. He was not that. But there was a certain sense of irritation with him, because he knew that the forces around him were always trying to knock him out, you see. So that sort of naturally gives a man a sense of irritation.
Who followed him as your minister?
Oh, he had so many ministers. Then, Mr. D.S. Sennaker took over the portfolio when he resigned. And then, that was till March 62, no?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, he died.
51 he crossed over, he took over from July. Yes, 52 March he died. Then new elections came. Then during that period, interim period was, who became this? Then Dudley became Prime Minister, no? Yes, Dudley continued, I think. Yes, Dudley continued for that interim period. Then Mr. C.W.W. Kannangara succeeded.
I was wondering whether the UNP changed the emphasis.
There was not very much time for them to change the emphasis. Of course, Mr. D.S. Senanayake had a different approach, and he was trying to change the trend, no doubt, but then he had not much time to do it.
In between 52 and 56, there was no change in policy.
Policy emphasis. So there was not very much interest in local government during that time, 52 to 56.
Mr.
Kannangara was not very much of a very influential member of the cabinet either, you see. So it was just...
He didn't have any personality?
Nothing. At that stage he was on...
Aging.
And
why didn't they take steps to amalgamate the two streams, rural development and local government, now that the reason to be was no longer prevailing?
At that time?
Mm.
Well, I suppose they had no time to look into matters like that because who was the Minister of Home Affairs at that time? I can't remember who he was. And ministers tend to stick to their subjects also, no? They don't like to easily give up their subjects.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been, I've noticed that from my experience that no minister likes to give up his subjects, you see.
If I may come to the impact of the political change in 56, what sort of impact did it have on the administration, especially in the local government?
56?
Yes.
That is after Mr. Bandaranaike, I think. Not in any very, very marked way because there was no definite sort of pull towards local government or push up of local government or anything like that.
It continued as before?
Yeah, it continued as before. Of course, the local authorities were feeling rather happy that, I suppose, there once minister who was in charge of local government was there, but I don't think apart from that there was any special emphasis. In fact, Mr. Dayasabhe Singh once had some lunch or something like that, some union, no? I think the local government officers union gave a lunch and Mr. Bandaranaike was present. So he said, sir, we thought that you would continue with local government when you became Prime Minister. He said, Abhay Singh, why do you think that local government cannot function as efficiently when I am Prime Minister? He said. I must say that, why should you think that it must be directly under me, the subject, my subject, my personal attention, that it should progress? So what he was saying is he would see to it that nothing, no harm took place over the local government was concerned.
No, did you feel that the civil servants and GAs and others were now more amenable and sympathetic?
Oh, yes, there was definitely a distinct trend, and they would not easily sort of thwart the efforts and these things of local governing bodies, and particularly in matters like acquisitions, where they tended to delay for months and years. You could see that there was a little stepping up of it.
What about the switch over to Subhash? Did that create problems?
Not so far as we were concerned. Because in fact, local government department was more or less working in Subhash most of the time. There was no...
I was wondering whether it slowed things up because of duplicating work.
No. In fact, people complain today that they find they don't know where to go in most of these matters. Local authorities and others say that the present setup, they are really at a loose end. They don't know. They don't seem to know what the policy is, who the authority is, and so on. That process of coordination which we introduced has now apparently completely gone haywire.
What is the process of coordination?
Now we had the government agent, the local assistant commissioner, the commissioner, and so on. The village committees had access direct to the local government department, to their boss and so on. Today now, even the village committee, superintendents of village works, for instance, who were under the control of the commissioner of local government, have now been switched over to the water works department, a technical department.
So now the village community was directly under the one of the assistant commissioners, who were divided regionally. What was the position of the regional assistant commissioner to the GAs of the district?
Nothing. They are completely so different. That he, GA was merely the agent of the government, you see, carrying so many functions, you see, other departments.
So he had very little, a few dealings with the village community.
Well, except things like this, acquisitions of land and odd things where they say some demarcations of areas for burial grounds, this and that sort of jobs.
Now, if I may raise some very general questions with regard to local government in the 50s and 60s, what would you say were the major problems and obstacles to the fulfillment of your aims?
But one thing, one drastic change that the Mr. Bandaranaike introduced was, as you know, the Local Government Service Commission, where the appointments and all that had been done by the local authorities themselves. And he felt that there was such a lot of nepotism and corruption and so on. He introduced the Local Government Service Commission, where all the employees above a certain salary limit are appointed and transferred and so on, punishments all under this. So that was one of the key things that he introduced. That was in 1945, I think, yes, past 46. Started in 47 onwards, it was continuing. That was one of the major things in between the 1950s and 60s. Well, the trend has been to give local governing bodies more and more powers. No, there was the Enlargement of Powers Act.
What was the objective, really? What was his, what would you say was his chief objective in after 48 and after 56?
After 56, really, he had very little time really to devote local government. Really, he was concerned more with the more with the affairs of state, and he had very little time to concentrate on this.
No, but taking the whole period, I was wondering what the actual purpose of local government is. Did it fulfill any purpose?
Well, why not? For one thing, the status of the local governing bodies rose immeasurably during his period. Immeasurably, you see. Whereas formerly, you didn't find even it. A chairman, in those days, you wouldn't get a seat in a kachari, when you see. Latterly, you found them as coming in as members of parliament. In one parliament, parliament before the last, there were 38 members of parliament, village committee chairman. You see, the trend is quite clear, no?
It is greater democratization. But I was wondering whether from the administrative viewpoint, there were any objectives of
why not? You see, in any of the rural areas today, compared to what it was, say, 10, 12 years ago, there's a development, the marvelous development, electricity schemes, water supply schemes, various things like that, which were never thought of, you see, in that sense. Even in the remote areas, you will find an electricity scheme is supplying an area of about 10, 15 square miles, you see, which in those days, unthinkable.
What about obstacles? Didn't you find that factionalism tended to prevail and...
No, factionalism was always there, but local government institutions, but we managed always to smoothen out, because our officers had always been trained up in a tradition of being able to get them together and harmonize. You see, that was one of the great things that they had been taught or rather made to feel, that local factionalism should not be allowed to retard the progress of this area. So they used always to get these factions together and do them more sort of talking down and smoothing out their difficulties, and also, and always they know that if they don't carry on well, there's a question of the grants which they always look forward to, they might be hampered in that. So that always acted as fairly good background to that made them feel that they must something.
That is to say, budgetary control, really?
Not budget. We never controlled budgets. Really, very rarely did we control budgets. It is like the system of grants in aid, you see,
mm-hmm.
where if the grants in aid were not given, say, for instance, a particular road, for instance, if they want to develop a stretch of 2-3 miles which had been very badly done, neglected, for which they want 10 or 15,000 rupees, they put it in their priority list and they ask money for it. So if they go on quarreling and ACLD feels that these roads are not doing any work, if you tell them, well, what's the use of my recommended grant? It's useless, you people are quarreling, we can't. It's good, so we will rather let it be. So that they always had a lurking fear that unless they did that.
What about corruption and nepotism and building of their own little nest egg?
That little always happens in local government authorities, you always find it. He wants to get what you're appointed to. Naturally, I suppose you can't help that in a village, no? Or a minor employee.
What about the question of efficiency? I mean, since they had executive power and of sorts and limits some finance and some authority, I was wondering whether the personnel who came to the top in these village committees were of a suitable caliber.
Of course, there is, as you know, there is recruitment through a central examination. And so the people who you send to the local government commission have got a basic education and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have to go through these various examinations before they qualify, go over their efficiency bars and so on. And also they used to have revision classes and sort of executive. So there is a continuous process where they have to keep in touch, otherwise there's not very much scope, because promotions depend on the efficiency also. It's not entirely on
them. Are the efficiency bars of any practical value?
I don't know, they have to get through the accounts and various other things before they can get through those, no?
Like
in the public service and so on, the local government law and things like that, little elementary things they have to get through. It's part of their...
What about the popularly elected personnel? I was wondering about their caliber.
Well, it all depends, varies from village to village, from area to area. Sometimes you get very highly sophisticated English-speaking people in the remote rural areas. You get sometimes a real Govia man from the listing as a chairman. It all depends on the way. Now, for instance, the Western Province, you get such a large number of well-educated people as chairman and so on, who are quite competent, you see, like any, to conduct their affairs.
No, but I don't believe in the theory that it has educated man necessarily the best man in some rural areas. A Goya may be just the man, but I was just thinking of the quality of...
Once again, to a great extent, it depends on the caliber of the two things. First, the secretary or the executive officer must be a man who has a fairly good vision and a man who is keen on his job and who is also fairly efficient. And the other thing is the chairman also must be a man who is amenable, you see. There might be some fellows who just simply want to write roughshod and say, never mind, I'll do this, hang the consequences. There are some people like that, you see.
So even the popularly elected types, some of them are like that?
Of course. You come across. Sometimes the position of the village committee secretary and so on becomes very difficult. He obviously he has to do something very irregular. He might be asked to do something irregular. He knows he has to do. Never mind the tender procedure. Accept this and get on with the job. I'll take the responsibility. What have you to say? And sort of that kind of thing. But sometimes.
But isn't that something sometimes desirable? A willingness to take responsibility.
Well, yes, it is desirable. But then this poor fellow gets in the neck sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
He might be told, why did you, why were you a party to, though he is not a party, why did such and such a day come to? The audit queries and says, why was this, they promptly come down on the official, not on the chairman who is an elected man.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets it in the neck, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
So that is why their position becomes very difficult.
So, there are problems of liaison.
Yes, very, very difficult problems. That is where the Mr. Bandaranaike's idea of getting these ACLGs as people who are very tactful and very conscientious and very amenable people to smoothen out these difficulties, because these are inherent in local government present structures.
What about problems arising from government partiality? Hasn't it been a practice for, say, the UNP government to give more votes to a constituency, UNP constituency?
That happens in pork barrel business, no? It always happens, no? That, well, the only remedy is, there is no remedy really, because if the minister thinks this area must get more for certain reasons and not another area, there's nothing to be said about it. No?
So you found this happening under both the UNP and SLSP?
I must have been in a very happy position, because I had no such difficulties in under any of these administrations.
Mm-hmm.
Though there's allegation that it is happening now.
Mm-hmm.
Probably I was in a very fortunate era, I think, because we had actually, honestly, they had no such difficulty at all, never. Because I knew people who are very party alignments, UNP, SLSP, LSSP, CP, all these people coming. Yes, and we did not treat them in any different way, you see. Because our policy had been one great thing about Mr. Bandaranaike, is I'm not concerned with personality. I'm concerned with the principle of must consider the electorates, the areas, their needs, not the personality.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose I often think that probably we were then living in an era of fairly good understanding of local government.
You didn't get ministers interfering?
Never. Never. It's rather
even,
you.
Even after 56?
No. For sometimes MPs try to interfere in certain little matters and so on. Not interfere, also they have their own difficulties there. There's some, for instance, now bought a DR or something like that, when I was permanent secretary. Local government and home affairs, they both were combined. That was a huge thing, you see, where that was my last post before I gave some complaint about the DR or being partial towards his opponents and so on and so on. So we have to smooth it out and see whether there's a genuine case, whether he is actually doing this kind of thing, whether the DRO is, and then move him out or warn him or something like that.
Well, if I may jump to another sphere, and that's this top structure of the administration. First, the question of proper allocation and organization of ministries, taking the period after 56. Didn't you feel that our leaders were not sufficiently aware of the need to have a rational organization of ministries? Now, for instance, when you were permanent secretary, didn't you feel that this chopping and changing of departments?
Yes, there has not been a rational in that. That's one of the great defects of this business. You see, you suddenly create a ministry for certain specific purposes, get one from here, one from there, one from there, three subjects, and here you are a minister. That is all.
Can you give an example from your own experience? Now, you said you were local government and cultural affairs at one stage.
Originally, that local government cultural affairs, then it was local government and housing. Cultural affairs completely taken out, housing tagged on. Housing was, I think, then with labor, housing and something else.
So don't you think this switching was bad for the departments themselves, changing from one ministry to another?
It is not bad for the department so much as it allows people who are in those departments to fool about, you see, and then not give up their best, you see, because by the time this new setup tries to study what has happened there in the past, that would have changed and somebody else would have taken it, you see.
Yes,
so that is a real, there should be a real rational method of allocating functions.
Didn't it create problems for you? You would have taken some time to get used to each new department.
It is, because when we took over the housing department, there were a terrible amount of backlog of things which should have been done and should have not been done and so on. By the time we got really going and got the amending bill ready, that was taken away and somebody else put in. That function was given to some other minister.
Why was that change made?
Well, that's the exigencies of the
usually political decisions or decisions taken by the treasury and...
No. Those are political decisions, obviously. Because when they say, when they want to create an additional ministry, the person concerned says, unless you give me this department and that department, I don't want that. They have to bargain and... those are political...
For instance, the combination of home affairs and local government, you felt was too much for one man?
No, it might have been a little too much, but that was a very happy combination, because then local government and provincial administration can be dovetailed. In fact, I was working to that end, but I was there only 1 year, because in 63 I retired, and 64 I retired and went to Burma.
So in a sense you feel that's the most logical combination?
It is, because the local government and provincial administration must not be antagonistic, you see. That's a very, it will retard the progress of the country. Naturally, the rural areas particularly, they are so closely linked up that is the really happy combination.
So, taking coordination at the ministry level itself, within the ministry,
yeah.
Did you feel that the administrative structure was badly coordinated? Was it too departmentalized? Now, for instance, there's a permanent secretary.
Yeah.
Now, the assistant secretary in charge of one department,
yeah.
and assistant secretary in another department.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it might be a technical man at the head of a department. But couldn't you have a different sort of system? An assistant secretary in charge of establishments, another in audit, you know, on a functional basis?
I think now they have felt that the better scheme is for the heads of departments to be assistant secretaries, so that they have a direct access to the minister or permanent secretary direct, and then they have with authority they can get up to the minister. I think that is probably a better scheme, rather than, I have not given very much thought to that. Functionally also creates a sort of, it's not a very happy scheme to have function like one in administration, one, but sometimes these things merge into each other, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Administration, then you say, one in charge of personnel and one in charge of
finance
and so on. That you can't. It's rather difficult to deal with a ministry in that way. It creates more difficulties.
What about files? Wasn't there a system of duplication of files?
Formerly there was, but now no. There is no such. No, the ministry kept the files direct from the department.
But in your time they had this duplication?
In certain instances they had. The ministry had its own files. But the tendency was to consider there was this necessity sometimes. There were certain things of an extremely confidential nature which probably should have been only between the minister and the ministry alone should handle, and not at the departmental end, because it may lead to so much of leakages and create trouble. So that you have to have that. But normally speaking, the files should indicate from the minister downwards what is happening in the... Mm-hmm.
Of course, you continued for a long time as permanent secretary local government. You had that...
Yes, I had that advantage from 58, March 1958 till 64. Mm-hmm. I continued as local government, though other things were added. Mm-hmm. Local government was not taken away.
So, I'm also interested in the relation between heads of departments and permanent secretaries.
Yeah.
And they, you know, what is the theoretical position, the constitutional position?
They have to go up to the minister through the permanent secretary.
But wasn't it a practice for ministers to take the shortcut?
It had been. And I won't blame them, because sometimes the affairs of states have become so multivarious. If the minister has to be waiting for the permanent secretary to advise him in all these matters, it will be very difficult for him to be answerable to parliament and the people. So this bypassing sometimes, which is done not with the intention of belittling the permanent secretary, but for quick action, I think can be justified.
Yes.
Though, of course, the minister should really inform his permanent secretary that such and such a thing has been done, otherwise he'll be in the dark. He won't be able to ultimately, if he gets into difficulty, he won't be able to pull him out from that point of view.
And there's also a question of coordination.
Yes, inside also. And the head of department will feel I can bypass him and go to the minister direct and sometimes get things which normally he would not like to do. And should not do.
Now, in fact, when you were head of department at local government, did your ministers deal directly with you or through the permanent secretary?
Permanent secretary, but of course, in most matters, the permanent secretary did not care to interfere because he knew that I was an expert in that. His job, I had been handling it for 10 years, so it was useless for him to come and interfere. So he said, one, go ahead and meet the minister and get it done, you see, because he knew nothing could. It all depends on the setup, you see. That is why I say once again, this whole administrative setup is wrong. To be changing heads of departments every 6 months or one year is a most absurd and ridiculous system altogether, because it can never.
People should specialize.
Specialize. It has come to that stage. You see, all over the world, it's a major specialization now. In fact, if I was able to make any impression on local government, it's because I specialized in it and managed to track everything so much so that people say, so you think, you know, some chairman can say, you seem to remember all things that have happened in the past also. I have happened to be here, and that is why I happen to know that, and the policy and so on, so that helps administration, I think.
What about the question of power? Aren't some heads of department vested with considerable statutory powers? Perhaps too many too much for the good of coordination?
Well, I don't know how to speak very much of other departments in that sense, you see. For a CIG was concerned, he hadn't so many powers in that sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were subject to review by the minister, so that there was no question of sort of himself setting himself up as a petty dictator or something like that. I don't know whether there are other departments, I have not heard.
What about the question of permanent secretary itself? Now, there is a controversy here. In ministries which have certain technical and specialist fields, they say that it's not good to have a generalist civil service at the top as a permanent secretary, that it's better to have a specialist. But others argue for having a generalist as a coordinating man.
Hasn't that problem also occurred in England, where they have been always trying to toy with the idea of whether it should be the general administrator who will coordinate the functions or the specialist who will coordinate? As against that, there is always the feeling that the specialist takes a too rigid point of view, isn't that so, which biased to a technical subject. You see, he may not be all that good in taking decisions affecting larger matters. Now, for instance, say the PWD is involved something, you see, about contracts, tender procedures and so on. He might like to bypass all those things and do something thinking that he is, but then from the general context of other things, he might be doing something that is irregular in the sense that giving a tender to a person who is not the lowest or something like that. It can be that technical people are a bit too specialized in certain things, and as such they tend to move more in their own way. Unless, of course, you can get the proper type of man, the technical man who has also had a very, very broad. Not a very easy thing to do.
Now take local government and home affairs.
Yeah.
Would you prefer a permanent secretary with a broad generalist background, like a CCS man, or a person like you with a long training in specialist training in local government?
It all depends whether you are giving emphasis to local government or home affairs.
Mm-hmm.
If you are giving emphasis to local government. I think a man who has dealt with local government in a very large way is more desirable. But of course, if you are thinking of provincial administration in the sense of the general setup of government agencies and so on, it doesn't matter who is there. Mm-hmm. It all depends on your...
Final question on this sphere. What about the question of permanent secretaries being non-political? Now, I have heard lots of politicians say that the permanent secretary must not only have the confidence of the minister and of the party, but he must be a type of man who can carry out the policies enthusiastically. And they argue that the civil servants are generally UNP-oriented.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. Is that so?
I think it all depends on the makeup of an individual. It is, I don't think Mr. X or Y is UNP or SLSP because of any particular reason, but it may be his own inclination rather than... But I think my own view is, by and large, public servants are non-political, in the sense that, say, they have no strong political alignments unless the politicians push them to it. Or there are a few people who are just catching for certain posts and so on, who probably try to outdo the ministers and the MPs themselves in being partisan, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
by and large, I don't think the public service, so far as I have been able to get, I have known my men for so long, I don't think they have been interested.
That's very interesting, because I have heard leftist politicians affirm that most of our civil servants would be unsuitable because they will never carry out our policies. And they argue that there is no such thing as a non-political public servant. But
Well, non-political in this sense, certainly people have their own inclinations. A public servant, now see, for instance, when he goes to vote, he has to vote either way, you know, one way or the other, no? So naturally he has his political interest, but he does not, normally a public servant doesn't allow that to influence him in his work.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I did, no? I served under four or five ministers. I served them equally loyalty and with equal efficiency. Just because he belonged to one party or the other, that did not influence me one iota in my administration. So I think, generally speaking, my own impression is that public servants are not that politically minded. They are more concerned with their own bread and butter, I think, in the sense that they want to do a job of work and not get caught into a wedge, you see, and being classed as this or that or the other thing.
If I may ask a final question on a different sphere, pertaining to 30s and 40s,
yes.
People speak of the British traditions in civil service. I know you're not in the service, but you had contact with them. I was wondering what you would say were these traditions, what were the particular attributes?
You might ask your father, no? No, I think what they meant was the traditions of the civil service was being honorable, I think. That's one of the things. Not stoop to taking money and that kind of thing.
Integrity.
And a fair deal for other people. I think that's what they meant, not any other things. But I don't know whether it meant that you must be far and away from the crowd.
I was wondering whether you could use the word paternalistic. Because they definitely had authority.
They felt that it should be tradition of paternalism. Also, was one of the ingredients. I think.
And it was carried over to the post-independence era too.
Yes. That is how I suppose it failed to. Then that was assumed to be sort of aloofness and non-sympathy with the current trends. Probably.
I was wondering whether even Mr. Bandaranaike was a bit too hasty in labeling the GAs and public servants as UNP-oriented and, in a sense, being distrustful of these civil servants.
The trouble was this. The civil servants of that era, when Mr. Bandaranaike came into power, they were not people who were easily amenable to change. That was something basic of it then. That is, they were not definitely oriented in that way. I don't think it was fair for him to say that they were UNP oriented. They were not oriented to change.
Oh, I see. They were what you might call bureaucratic.
Yes, too much in that tradition of and being aloof from the people. That was the trouble. I have met so many of those GAs and so on of those times and so on, Britishers and all sorts of people. They are amenable, they are good men, but they don't seem to be in tune with the times, you see. That is there.
But now take the post-56 era, in practice,
did
they resist the changes brought about by the SLF? In a
subtle way, really, through the treasury, definitely. The treasury was terribly reactionary. There was no question about that.
But even in the UNP era, isn't the treasury always rather a nuisance?
Even now, that is the trouble. You know, they are not flexible. You see, they don't react to a developing country with problems of magnitude in the way that one expects reasonably intelligent.